different Rashis every year. This is like the sixth or seventh year that I've been conducting these Shirim on Rashis. And I don't remember if I've spoken about this Rashi. I don't think I have. A lot of people listen to the Shir who aren't obviously present. But it's such an important Rashi that even if I have spoken about it already, it's worthwhile just because you're seven of the cycle of the Minyan here, the Rashi, very famous Rashi. Why is the juncture between Parshas Vayechi and Parshas Vayigash a unique juncture? What makes it a unique juncture? Every juncture between Parshios, typically between Sidros, but not only Sidros, even stops in the Parsha, are separated by a space of at least nine empty letters. If those nine empty spaces complete the line, that's a Parsha Pesucha. If those nine empty letters in the middle of the line, that's a Parsha Struma. Every Sidra in the Torah has that space between it, but not, and then there are, of course, not only Sidras, but Vayigash and Vayechi is the only Sidra without any space, so it's very hard to find where Vayechi starts. If you're a Baal Kriya and you're looking for Vayechi, it's not as easy to find because the last word of Vayigash is Vayachazuba, they were in Goshen, and you just read the last word of Vayigash and they become established there, Vayifru Vayirbu Me'od, then Vayechi Yaakov Beretz Mitzrayim Shvasei Shena, Shev Shena Me'abim Shena. So Rashi says, Lama Parsha Zeus Stuma, why is this Parsha enjammed? Why is it sealed or shuttered? So if you should kivan sheniftar Yaakov Avinu, mistim or inam believim shal Yisrael mitzaras hashibud. Rashi gives two shots, but either way, this textual shuttering is a metaphor for the closing of their imagination. They became too entrenched in Mitzrayim, they forgot about Eretz Yisrael, they forgot that it's Golos, they forgot, apropos, they forgot where they're meant to be. So what causes someone to forget where he belongs? It's one thing to live in Golos with a sense that you belong elsewhere. In my article this week, Yonatan was at the celebration in that life, which on all fronts was this beautiful celebration, real Kavod HaTorah, real grandeur. Not enough you can say about it, but it also shows how comfortable the American community is to conduct the celebration in such a public fashion. You wouldn't have something like that in England. And people in England ask me the difference between the American Jewish community and the British Jewish community in South Africa. The American Jewish community is very confident in themselves. There's a confidence index. They're comfortable in society, in public sectors. They've entered almost every sphere. They're not, in London, Jews live on the margins of society. Of course, they're important and they contribute, but they're not. You wouldn't all of a sudden take over Wembley Stadium and it would be unthinkable. So it's a level of comfort, and a level of comfort makes it harder to remember, well, we belong elsewhere, so it's more aliyah from England, more aliyah, percentage-wise. Anyway, so in this Rashi, at least, what's happening is that, at least according to the first Pshat in Rashi, Yaakov dies. And when Yaakov dies, then their eyes become closed, and they can't see beyond Goshen, they can't see beyond Mitzrayim, and they don't remember that they belong elsewhere, and their eyes are closed. Since their eyes are closed, the text is also closed. Now, it's not just that Yaakov dies, but Yaakov was a throwback. Yaakov's whole life was in Israel. Yaakov's whole struggle was about Israel, as we'll see a little bit later. So when Yaakov's alive, his personality, his whole passion is, this is not where we're meant to be. When Yaakov has to leave Eretz Canaan in Parshas Vayigash, he's terrified. And Hashem visits him in Beersheba and says, don't worry, you may have to descend now. Al tira Yaakov. So sometimes what helps you remember that you belong somewhere else, either geographically, or not just geographically, but spiritually, you belong somewhere else. You're in medical school, you're in college, you feel the weight of tests and pressures upon you, and you have to remind yourself, you know what, this is not what my life is defined by. Right now I'm pursuing this goal so that I can lead to more important goals, but I can't let this define me. I can't let this capture me and consume me. You have people, typically older people, from another generation who take you to that other place and remind you to step out of this very, very intense, all-consuming experience. So Yaakov, when he was alive, was this throwback whose life was dedicated to Eretz Yisrael, who struggled for Eretz Yisrael. And it was easier for the Jews to remember, we belong in Israel, we live in Goshen, we contribute to Goshen, we invest in Goshen, but we belong elsewhere. The second shot in Rashi, what closed their eyes to belonging somewhere else, is just the Shibud. The Shibud was just too overwhelming. At some point, as strange as it sounds, the Shibud began already. We typically think that the Shibud only kicks in, and the anti-Jewish discrimination only kicked in when Yosef dies and that generation passed. Because remember, Yosef was a rock star. Yosef had rescued Mitzrayim from famine. Yosef had catapulted Mitzrayim to him being a world empire because of his plan. Egypt had all the food, so all the countries had to descend to Mitzrayim. So Yosef and the Jews wielded disproportionate socio-political clout. They had a lot of currency. Because, oh, these are the Jews, these are the wise people, these are the people who saved Egypt. And we think that when Yosef dies, some of this appeal fades. But at least according to Rashi, this starts already in Parshas Vayechi. After that first wave of enthusiasm, and after everyone got past their excitement, and everyone hears that Yosef, Parshas Vayigash, the brothers of Yosef are coming, nothing settled down, and some of the anti-Jewish discrimination begins. And when you're a Meshubah, when you're persecuted, it's very hard to remember that you belong elsewhere. And that's why one of the challenges of the last 1,800 years is living without that horizon of hope, without that sliver. Now that you have the state of Israel, so no matter where you are, you realize, okay, I'm living, I'm performing, but I know that my people have been restored to historical relevancy, there's Jewish pride, Jews mean something, and it's easier to take yourself out. And that's why living with Israel consciousness is such a, forget the ideology, whether you believe this is the hand of God or not the hand of God, the first wave of revenge or not, just the restoration of pride, that there's a Jewish entity that is a state of Jews and run by Jews, and it can remind you that, okay, I'm living where I live, but there's something else that I belong to. So these are the two imaginative closures, I should say imaginative closures, closures of the imagination, the closing of their mind, and the Torah tries to represent that by creating a textual shuttering or a textual seal. The text is sealed because their vision was sealed and their vision was shuttered. It's an interesting Rashi. Another very important Rashi about character and how you build character. One of the more important character traits that sometimes neglected or underappreciated, underrated character traits, top five underrated character traits is loyalty. Okay, no one here is loyal to me for being here, I assume. I hope you're all here because you want to hear the share, so, and I want to give the share, so there's a convergence of interests. So that's why we have to be sitting together in the corner. But maybe, I don't know, maybe Moshe is saying, I don't really want to be here, but Rabbi Kerrigan is giving a share, I feel loyal to him, I hate the share, I don't want to listen. I hope you're not, but that would be loyalty is when you participate or contribute to something that you don't agree with and you're not interested in, but you owe it to that person. And for example, loyalty to parents, you may not agree with their decisions, but loyalty to friends, friends of yours who have taken a very different life trajectory, and they're not really part of your life. You don't really want to spend time with them necessarily, and they call you up and say, you know, I have loyalty to that person. Rav Aaron taught me a lot about loyalty. I remember several times boys would come into the yeshiva, and so there's something called protexia, where you know people, and that's one thing, but these boys didn't belong in yeshiva, and they didn't really have protexia, but their grandparent had done something really important to, really important and really valuable for, I can give too much information, or there's a couple celebrated stories. That's why it's important to have loyalty in Avodas Hashem. Sometimes you feel excited to be in Avodas Hashem. Sometimes you don't feel so excited, but you're loyal to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're committed because of your past. So Yaakov delivers Shechem to Yosef. And he introduces Shechem, V'ani nesati lecha Shechem echad alachecha, asher lakachti miyad ha-mari becharbi uvekashti. So the word charbi uvekashti is a very, very celebrated passage. According to Onkelos, it means my tefillos. A tefillos compared to a cherub, a tefillos compared to a bow and arrow. But the simple pshat is that Yaakov did not secure or triumph over the Amori and receive Shechem through pure davening, but becharbi uvekashti, with my sword and my bow and arrow. So Rashi says, what happened? Kishahargu Shimon v'Levi is anshei Shechem. When Shimon and Levi decimated Shechem, niskansu kol svivo sam lizdavek lahem. All the enemies started to war with Yaakov because they were irate as to this massacre in Shechem. V'chargar Yaakov klim milchamto kinegdam. So Yaakov goes to war. And remember, this is the same Yaakov who just a few psukim later is going to rebuke Shimon and Levi. He's going to reprimand them. He's going to chastise them. So the Shechem episode is not something Yaakov's proud of, necessarily. He wishes it didn't happen. He wishes Shimon and Levi had been a little bit more restrained, a little bit less angry and murderous, quite frankly. He calls them Kleichamas Mecheroseim. And he chastises them. So not only does he fight in Parshas Vayishlach, does he join the battle, he could have said, look, this is your battle. You got us into this mud. You got us into this place. It's not my battle. I didn't agree. Had you asked me, I wouldn't have encouraged this. I think this is embarrassing. This is in... I mean, could you imagine? It's so painful to Yaakov that he raises him on his deathbed. When someone dies, normally you know these people that are very harsh and very angry and very aggressive. When they get older, they get softer a little. Because when you get older, you realize life's too important to waste on silliness and pettiness. So you get soft a little. So who imagines someone on his deathbed, if his people is just angry till the day they die, and they're vengeful and they're spiteful and I disown you and I'm not going to see you. And most people on the deathbed, you'd imagine Yaakov would get a little bit soft and would overlook this and would just deliver brachos and be generous with his spirit. But evidently, morally, it pains him. And he has to deliver this lesson to Shimon Halevi and to all the brothers. So this is probably the most painful moment for Yaakov as a father. Yet, he fought in this battle. And not only that, but at a certain point of it, he fought in the battle because as much as I have an issue with my children, when it comes to outsiders, I'm aligned with them. We circle the wagons. We all get together. And sometimes in life you have discussions with people in your family and disagreements with your family. You don't air your dirty laundry. When it comes to people on the outside, you line up. You're all aligned. And you support family. It's so important about family. If you ask me, one of the five or six definitions of healthy family life is that you support your family members unconditionally. Even if you disagree with it. You can disagree around the Shabbos table. You can have arguments. You can have discussions. But when they make their decision, you say, you know what, you're my brother, child, parent, sibling. I support your decision, and I'll do everything possible to be there for you as best as I can. People are emotional beings. If you don't agree with something, it's harder to support. But this is, I think, Yaakov's heroism, that he supports their decision, even though it pains him so much that a few seconds later, he rebukes him as he's about to die, but he's proud of himself going to war. He's not embarrassed. He announces, I was part of this war. I won and I secured Shechem. Now, Yosef, I'm delivering it to you. Even though Yaakov had wished that war never erupted and had been embarrassed by his children's behavior. Okay, so the second Rashi is a Rashi about loyalty. One more Rashi. Okay, maybe let's read this Rashi. Two more to read. I'll pick one. The last bracha is delivered to Binyamin. And Binyamin is compared to a wolf. It's not altogether obvious why he's compared to a wolf. Snakes, we understand. Lions, we understand. Yehuda's compared to a lion. Dun's compared to a snake. These are, what? Yehuda's compared to a lion. Dun's compared to a snake. And those are really the two primary animal associations in Parshas Vayechi. The other Shvatim are given more abstract praise and future. But when Yemen's compared to a wolf, and of course in many parochas, as you'll see the Shvatim, you'll see that wolf. What does the wolf represent? The lion is obvious. The snake, to a degree, is obvious. The end of Bereishis, it evokes images of the snake of Gan Eden. Rashi talks about, as Yaakov talks about, the snake bites the horse in the leg, and then the horse rider is thrown off and killed. And sometimes Hashem wants us to destroy enemies without that contact. I think a lot about modern warfare, where modern warfare has shifted from the sword, even the bow and arrow, into being able to conquer our enemies through secondary forces, through other people, or through other forces. But what does the wolf represent? So Rashi says, Niba al shehayu asidim, I'm sorry, read the end of Rashi. Because if you look at the end of the pasuk, the aspect of the wolf that Yaakov highlights is the day and night issue. But Binyamin ze'ev yitrov, baboker yochal ad, in the morning it will eat its prey, v'la'erev yechalek shalal, and at night it will distribute or divide all the booty, all the loot, everything that it gathers. So the aspect of the wolf that Yaakov highlights, not its teeth, not how fast it runs, not that it can go up north into the ice, but the aspect of the wolf is that it scavenges at night primarily. The wolf isn't really as much of a predator as it is a scavenger. Scavengers have to collect leftovers or collect. It's not only a hunter. Why is this scavenging at night important? What does it represent metaphorically? And why is it associated with Binyamin? So Rashi says, I'll just paraphrase the Rashi since we're running a little bit late. It captures Esther and Mordechai. Esther and Mordechai came from Binyamin, Ishimini. So Mordechai comes from Binyamin, Esther's part of the family. And they divide the loot of Haman's house. So by the end of the Megillah, they become rich and they're successful and prosperous based on Haman. Now why is this the night? Because this happens in Gullus. This happens in Paras or Madai. This happens in Shushan, where they're not exposed to the Gilui Shechina that's associated with the day. It's night, it's Gullus. And it's this aspect that, unlike the lion who predates during the day, when you can see, or the snake who predates during the day, the wolf is a scavenger. It's not as powerful, obviously, as the lion and the snake, but it still is able, even under nocturnal conditions, to collect its prey and to scavenge and to collect v'le'erev yechalek shalal. Which means that Binyamin and the nocturnal scavenging ability of a wolf, which was highlighted by Mordechai and Esther, is a template for the Jewish people. That even when we're in Gullus and we don't have the strength of a lion and we don't have the strength of a snake and we don't have the triumph, we'll still be financially successful. The Kodesh Baruch Hu is reminding us metaphorically at night during Gullus, when we don't have the prominence of the lion and the snake, we'll still be able to succeed. And even though we'll be cursed in Gullus, Jews will always be able, Baruch Hashem, to support themselves and to support their communities. It's not a simple thing. Just think about all the communities and all the countries in the world that can't support themselves, even though they have sovereign states. And even though, and Jews were always excluded from most professions. For thousands of years, Jews could be moneylenders. For thousands of years, Jews could sell beer, own taverns, but nothing else. For thousands of years, Jews were limited, so they were not the lions and the snake. Baruch Hashem, now we've returned to being lions and snakes. Thank God we have a booming economy, and our state of Israel is successful and prosperous. But for thousands of years, we were more Binyamin than we were Yehuda and Dan. So even though it's about Binyamin, it's not just about Binyamin, it's about the Jewish people. And the showcase of this was Mordechai the Esther and that Gullus, but it's a template and a paradigm rather than a one-off incident. So three different Rashis. One Rashi about the textual closure, signifying the closure of the imagination. The two aspects that close the imagination is that the throwback bridge personality was no longer there, who took them out of their current reality. Second of all, just the challenge of day-to-day life under persecution. The second Rashi is about loyalty. Even though Yaakov is irate at Shimon and Levi, so irate that he rebukes him on his deathbed, he still participates in the battle, but not just begrudgingly, but evidently there's a little bit of pride in him that he's part of that battle, because he defended his children and he received Shechem. If Shechem was something he was eternally embarrassed about, he wouldn't hand it to Yosef as a gift, and he wouldn't take pride and beat his chest as to Lakachti Becharvi or Vakashti. So he's, to a degree, proud because he supported his family, even though he disagreed with their decision. And had he had a choice, he would have disagreed and prevented them from their choice and from their trespass into Shechem. And then finally, Binyamin is a wolf, not like a lion and a snake, because of the nocturnal ability. It's symbolic of the night of history when Jews are not in their land and don't have all their resources, they'll still be able to support, which I think is one of the miracles of Jewish history. When you think about, again, without getting into stereotypes, by and large, Jews have been able to recapture and recover wealth and build wealth under the most unimaginable circumstances. When you just think about it, just think about the state of Baruch Hashem wealth in the Jewish community today relative to where we were in other areas. And it's 80 years after probably close to a third to a half of our wealth, at least Ashkenazic European Jewry, was taken from us. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises us that our industry, our diligence, and our communal awareness will be able to, even under night conditions, be able to be prosperous and support ourselves. Okay? Shabbat Shalom. Okay.